Ahoy, authors! You're listening to the Writership Podcast, a show focused on helping indie authors master self-editing skills. So come aboard and get ready to find the treasure in your manuscript with hosts Leslie Watts and Clark Chamberlain.
Welcome to episode 102 of the Writership Podcast. Today, we're talking about how to choose your point of view. I'm Leslie Watts, here with Clark Chamberlain from The Book Editor Show. To learn more about the podcast, visit writership.com/podcast.
As you know, the Writership Podcast is brought to you by Jim Kukral and Author Marketing Club. Jim has just launched a new business for nonfiction authors called Business Around a Book. So if you're a nonfiction author, visit www.businessaroundabook.com and let Jim help you turn your nonfiction book into a profitable, life-changing business. That's businessaroundabook.com.
Hey, and Jim Kukral and the Author Marketing Club cover the hosting and technical support for the show. And through Patreon, you can engage with us beyond the regular episodes and help cover the costs of our time in preparing for the show and reviewing submissions. You can find out more about that at patreon.com/writership.
And don't forget to grab the 100 quick tips. That's a free download. And big thank you. Over the last 100 episodes, go to writership.com/quick tips and grab those and use them right away in your editing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey. So how's it going, Leslie?
It's going. It's going. Yeah. It's a gorgeous day today. It's one of those, like, it had been kind of gray and not fun this week. And it's quite lovely today. So I'm feeling positive and upbeat.
Good. So it's a little cold here in Idaho today. We had this crazy all day yesterday windstorms that like just were right there on the edge, you know, to like really start doing damage. And then, you know, so and then the temperature dropped like 15 degrees today. No wind, though. The wind's gone. Now it's just cold.
Oh, man.
So, yeah. And my backyard's becoming a jungle and I need to get out there and machete it all down or something.
You can pretend that you're an intrepid hero. You know, I find that that helps a lot to pretend that I'm a hero in a story. And I'm just...
I don't know. I share this in my newsletter about how I listen to music when I go into shop because it helps me distract myself from the people around me. And but I put on things like themes from James Bond and stuff. And then, yeah, you can like sneak around the aisles and like feel like you're part of a movie. It's pretty awesome.
That's brilliant. Another quick tip from Clark here today. Make your shopping fun. Oh, awesome. Well, so today we're talking about point of view, among other things. And I'm wondering if you have a quote for us.
Oh, I do. Absolutely. Awesome. From Jerome Stern, who says, "Selecting the best point of view from which to tell a story can be puzzling. Because you originally conceive an idea in first or third doesn't mean it has to stay that way. Often, it's good to rewrite the story in another person to see how it changes. Sometimes writers, after a number of drafts, have realized that the real story lies elsewhere, in the mother's view of the daughter, not the daughter's view of the mother. Such changes in perspective have resulted in breakthroughs that have astonished their own authors." And that's from Making Shapely Fiction, which is an amazing book.
Yes, it is a great book. Yeah. So point of view is a tricky customer.
It really is. And just like Jerome saying there, like picking it is really important because you have to, I talk about this in class, you know, like you have to step back and see yourself as a storyteller and what is going to be the best way to tell that story to the audience you're trying to reach. And that becomes a huge deal, you know, like, and it can change everything, can change the story entirely.
Yeah, yeah, because I mean that's the filter through which the reader is receiving the story, and of course there are limitations and advantages for each of the choices, and so understanding those advantages and disadvantages and what you need to convey and when is you know, that like these are things you're going to want to think about as you make the choice initially, and then when you review it on revision.
Right. And testing, you know, like try something different. Even if you're just doing it for a few thousand words, just trying it might help you either confirm the choice that you already made for your point of view or give you some good evidence that maybe you should switch it.
Right. Right. Yeah. And the interesting thing is just because one point of view is easier for you to write doesn't necessarily mean it's the right point of view for the story.
Exactly. Or the fact that, well, every other author is writing this from a female first person point of view in this genre.
Right.
Like that's a bad reason to tell the story that way. You know, like tell the story as the story needs to be told, because that's going to actually engage with people.
Yeah.
So, do we have a story to read today?
We actually do. We have a short story, and we're going to read, or I say you're going to read, or if you're up for it.
Yeah, today. I'm up.
All right. So you're going to read the short story, and we're just a portion of it, but then we'll kind of give a summation of what happens in the rest of the story, because we're going to talk about the whole ball of wax. Is that right? Yeah. Okay. Okay. So today, our short story submission is The Second Prayer, A Confession for the Dead by David L. Storm. It's a thriller. The word count for the entire short story is 9,400 words. And there's a little mature language in the submission.
I hadn't craved a cigarette for over 12 years. That October night, like an old friend from the past, the desire for the sweet taste of nicotine returned. It was after midnight when I pulled into the parking lot of a convenience store. A couple of clamorous, obnoxious teenagers were huddled in the front. One of them called to me when I stepped out of the car. "Hey, mister," he trotted over. "Can you buy us a six-pack? Here's $20. Keep the change." He held out several crinkled bills. I told him to get lost and continued into the store. A young kid, 21 at most, his ink-black hair down to his waist, tattoos covered the exposed, milky skin of his weedy arms. He greeted me with a smile while he mopped the floor in front of the beverage case. His body language didn't match his goth-like appearance. "How you doing tonight?" he asked without missing a stroke of the wet mop on the worn-out floor. "I'm okay," I said, trying to avoid the birth of useless conversation. It didn't work. "Just okay?" I hesitated, searching my memory banks for a canned response. Looking through the store window, I watched the group of teenagers, desperate to get wasted, wander across the parking lot. They had given up on their quest for beer. It was probably as unsuccessful as their quest for pussy. "No, I'm doing great," I lied. "That's better. Too many people are so down these days. Don't know why." He leaned the mop against the wall, wiped his hands against his black jeans, and walked to the register. "What can I get you?" "I just need a pack of Camels, please." I tossed a $10 bill on the counter. "You got ID?" I looked at him. He was serious. I shook my head and reached for my wallet. "Sorry, man. Gotta ask for it. If I don't, I could lose my job." I showed him my license. Without even looking at it, he said, "Good enough." Instead of retreating to my car, I wandered over to a bus stop shelter directly in front of the store to smoke a couple of cigarettes while I try and figure things out. The place reeked of stale beer and urine. There would be no buses until 5 a.m. I'd have the place to myself for more than a couple of hours. As soon as the first cigarette was done, I propped another in my mouth and lit it. When I finished the second one, I tossed it in the corner of the shelter. A faint whisk of smoke drifted in my direction. The lights from the passing cars was hypnotic. I looked to my left and saw a truck coming down the street. I glanced down at the cigarette butt. No longer was any hint of pale blue smoke drifting from it. The approaching headlights of the truck were shining like the eyes of a serpent bearing down on me. The decision was fast, final, and flawless. I stepped into the road. I heard the tires skid, the deafening blast of an air horn. Initially, I felt no pain. It was like a rush of hot, damp air had pressed me to the ground. A deep, panic-filled voice next to me said, "Holy shit, are you okay?" When I opened my eyes, I saw a man with a face hard as the concrete below me. "I never expected you to walk across the street. Jesus H. Christ," I've been driving for over 30 years and I've never seen anything like happen like this. I call them fatal seconds. They can change your life instantly, the way a woman by the name of Linda Bell changed mine. Someone said, I saw the whole thing. He just walked in front of the truck. The dude must be wasted. I recognized the voice. It was the kid who wanted me to buy him a six-pack. The clerk from the store ran out when he heard the commotion. With his hair hanging down in front of him, he testified aloud to my soberness. He was just in my store. He seemed a little weird, but wasn't drunk. My vision was very blurry. I could see flashing lights and shadows around me. I tried to lift my head. A hand gently pushed me back down. A blanket had been draped over me. A sudden burst of pain shot through my entire left side. I knew I was dying, and I called out for Karen, my wife. There was silence. I closed my eyes. Good morning, a friendly voice said. The first thing I noticed when I came out of deep sleep was the stench of pine-scented ammonia. The second was the nurse's long blonde hair tied back in a ponytail, such a contrast against her dark blue uniform, like a vein of bright yellow gold running through the Black Hills of South Dakota. I looked up the clock. It was 7:15. She checked my blood pressure and read out numbers. It meant nothing to me. Okay, on a scale of 1 to 10, 1, you feel good enough to leap out of this bed and run down the hall, and 10, it even hurts when you smile. Where are you? I watched her walk over to the dry erase board directly in front of me and pull the cap off a black marker. I'm cold. Cold is not a pain level. Now tell me. 7. 7? She wrote the number on the board. That's pretty high. You'll need more morphine. I'll be right back. She returned several minutes later and dialed in a faster IV drip of morphine. I felt warm and comfortable, like I was soaking in a hot bath. With my eyes closed, I envisioned the darkness of and serenity of space. When I woke up, a sandwich and a carton of milk sat on the tray next to me. It was now a little past 3 p.m. I reached for the television remote beside my bed. Dr. Phil appeared on the flat screen. He was talking to a girl who couldn't have been more than 15. He asked her how long she'd been doing heroin. She denied the fact she was taking junk. I knew she was lying. When she answered, she avoided eye contact and focused her attention on the floor. She was a tortured soul, destined to a life of hardcore drugs and prostitution. Someday they'd find her cold, stiff body in a roach-infested come-and-go motel or in a dumpster behind a bowling alley. As callous as it may sound, I couldn't give a shit. I ate the sandwich. It was egg salad, dry as sawdust and not much more for flavor. After Dr. Phil parted the stage, hand in hand with his wife, the local news came on. A landmark seafood restaurant that I took Karen to on our first date was demolished to make room for a Ford dealership. I cried. The night nurse was a sweet short woman with a southern drawl. She asked me the same questions I answered less than 12 hours ago. My pain level was a 4, but I told her it was around a 6. My morphine drip was again increased. I watched some corny sitcom while I ate dinner. It wasn't funny. When she removed my tray, I asked her if anyone had heard from my wife. She flashed a sympathetic smile and told me to get some rest. He was sitting in a chair in the corner of my room, looking out the window. The wide rim of his leather hat perched over his forehead made him look cold and uninviting. He noticed my eyes were open. He greeted me. Hello, Mr. Grant. So glad to see you're awake. His tone pretentious. He didn't take his eyes off the street below the window. I rubbed my face, trying to bring the stranger into focus. My name is Ben Sanders. You don't look like a doctor, I said. Never said I was a doctor. He told me. He turned to me with a sarcastic grin. His voice was assertive, rough, and scratchy like it belonged to an 80-year-old man, but his pockmarked face told a different story. He was probably closer to 50. I sat up. Who are you? I said. Ben stood, picked up the chair, and carried it closer to my bed. He sat down. You look frightened. Don't worry. I'm not the Grim Reaper. He removed a pack of gum from his shirt pocket. Would you like a piece? I shook my head. He cocked his to the side. It's actually good for you. Helps settle the nerves. He removed a stick, peeled away the foil, crumbled it up in a pea-sized ball, and tossed it into the trash can. Bum, bum, bum.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the end of the submission. And from there, what we see is we have the character Mr. Grant is in the, you know, is in the hospital room, and he's kind of moving in and out of consciousness. And Ben Sanders is asking him questions, and about an accident that Mr. Grant had had.
Yeah.
Which was a car accident in which...
Linda Bell was involved with it, and that she loses her son, 18-month-old son.
Yeah, she loses her son. And Mr. Grant was not in any... Like, he wasn't drunk or, you know, under the influence of anything. It was an accident, as far as we can tell from the story. And what happens, you know, what's revealed as we go is that the media in the town where he lives turns against him and calls him a murderer. There's a series of events of harassment and that kind of thing where he, for instance, Mr. Grant owns an auto repair shop, that's what it is. And a customer comes in and she's like, I'm not working with you anymore. Give me back my car. And the business stops doing well. And then there are, like I said, these instances of harassment where it seems his wife is fired from her job as a teacher based on an anonymous accusation, and paint is thrown on his car, and phone calls. His wife receives phone calls and a letter.
And letters. So.
Yeah.
And she wants them to leave. His partner at the auto body or auto repair shop is willing to buy him out, and they could move to Arizona away from all of this mess. But he wants to fight. You know, he wants to stay for what he's built there.
Right. And so, spoiler alert, as we move toward the end of the story, we find out that what's happened. So Ben is a detective, and Mr. Grant decides to take matters into his own hands, and he's tired of being harassed, and he kills Linda Bell. And so that's why Ben is investigating him. And the twist that we get at the end of the story is that there were no letters, there were no phone calls. The wife had thrown the paint on his car and poisoned his dog, which was, that was hard.
That was hard.
I mean, there's a lot of hard stuff in the story, of course, but that was, So we have, essentially what we have is this kind of psychological thriller where Mr. Grant, Jimmy, we find out later, his first name is Jimmy, his experience of reality is different from what's actually going on, because his wife is trying to trick him, you know, wants to use the circumstances to try to get him to move. And he acts upon these things in a pretty horrifying way. So that's the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey would say. I think I'm dating myself a little there.
Yeah.
Just a little. And so we want to talk about, one of the things we want to talk about is point of view, because this is a huge decision in a story like this where you want to keep reveal certain facts, and then you want to avoid revealing certain facts until the end.
Yeah.
And we have first person. So everything is from Jimmy's point of view. We get a scene with the accident, the actual accident, the car accident, and then in the hospital, and then their interaction at the auto repair shop, and then interactions with his wife.
Right. And one of the things that, so I've talked a lot about point of view in different places and sometimes rant.
No, not you. Point of view.
Not me. I never go off on any tangents or anything like that. But, you know, like that point of view has really become kind of one of my passion points, because I just am so strongly aligned to the idea of storytelling. And not telling the story right really can mess up a story and not give it the quality or the work that it could have. And that's one of the things we're seeing here. By choosing to be in his point of view, we are essentially keeping information from the reader, or like deliberately not telling them things,
right?
Which makes the ending not feel awesome like it should, and instead it feels false. Where if, like, maybe we just switch the point of view to the detective, and now all of a sudden he's trying to discover the information, and then we can have our character, you know, misleading him or lying to him outright or doing whatever, but he's going to continue to find the truth and whittle it away. And that would give our ending so much more strength.
Right, right. And I think, I want to read the author's log line, because I think this will shed some light on what the author was trying to, you know, was really wanted to accomplish with this story. So Jimmy Grant had it all: a beautiful wife, a successful business, and a promising future. So on a cold autumn night, while standing in a bus shelter, why did he decide to step off the curb in front of a truck and attempt to end it all? Besides himself, only two people know the answer. One is dead, the other is on the run. Ben Sanders, a tenacious, leathery, well-seasoned detective, is assigned the case. He has to untangle a ruthless deception and dig for the truth. So one thing I want to say is that we have in this story the seeds of a true mind bender, you know, like a real psychological thriller that is, you know, when we were talking, I was thinking of The Game, that movie with Michael Douglas and Gone Girl, and you mentioned The Sixth Sense, in that the twist is so big, you don't see it coming. And so I think this is a really ambitious story and has the, you know, the elements, to be really, you know, to really be great. And so while this is, you know, it's a little hard to hear that there's, you know, what we're recommending as we, you know, as we go on is a pretty significant rewrite. But we're, you know, it is a short story. And I think that, like I said, I think this could really be a very powerful story with some changes in the structure that make it, you know, that would just knock it out of the park.
Right. And that's what, you know, that's what editors do. Like, this would be a developmental edit. We'd be coming in and working through this and making these types of suggestions to the author. And because we wouldn't, because I don't think any elements of the story that are in here, I would drastically change. Like, I think everything that's in here are building blocks to create this awesome psychological thriller. The point of view change needs to change. The order in which things are told needs to change a little bit, because then that would, because if right now it's very linear, you know, it started with Linda Bell. This was the next event. This is the next event when my wife did this. Here's the next event that happened, you know, and it just goes in this linear fashion. But if the detective is confronting him with evidence at different times, like starting in the middle, going to the beginning, hitting portions of the end, coming back to the segue part from first to second. Like, when these types of ways, when it's a story is being told in that kind of nonlinear fashion, it then, when we get to that ending, which already is such a huge twist, mm-hmm. it'll actually feel more normal because we've already been doing things in a twisty type of way through the story.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, what was interesting is we talked a little, because last week we talked about narrative distance, and you mentioned, and I agree, that when you have a first person narrator, or, you know, first person point of view, and mm-hmm. that person doesn't reveal what they know, like something that's kind of critical, mm-hmm. not kind of, something that's critical to the story, you know, to the events that are being described, then it feels like a cheat, mm-hmm. and, or it can at least. And what's interesting is when I was doing some additional point of view research for this episode, I saw that Jeff Vandermeer has precisely the opposite opinion, that mm-hmm. omniscient feels like a cheat when, you know, if certain facts are not revealed. But I disagree with that. I mean, if I'm allowed to disagree with Jeff Vandermeer, who's awesome, amazing in so many ways. But I actually disagree with this point, because to me, the omniscient narrator is, you know, can reveal whatever they want. They don't have a stake in it other than being mm-hmm. the storyteller.
Right. And that's the power of the omniscient narrator, is that they're going to craft the story in the way that has the most impact to the audience that they're telling it. Like, that's the closest real storyteller that you can have in mm-hmm. any point of view. And what they want to reveal and when they want to reveal it is up to them. Like, I would even go a step further and say that, you know, having them hold information back and tell you that they're holding information back is a very effective way to keep people turning the page, mm-hmm. so that they want to find out what it is that, that they're hiding. But when you're in that first person, you know, like, what it is that they remember. I mean, there's some bias involved with things, and we can have our first person point of view character telling the story from their point of view. Mm-hmm. But then we have to have other points of view to counter it if necessary. But what we can't have them do is just change facts. Like, we can have a bias for the facts, mm-hmm. but the facts have to all be there. And yeah. not knowing that his wife was the one who was doing this as we're going along, because he knows, like, that doesn't feel right.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that a point in this, you know, kind of in this arena, is that in the Sherlock Holmes stories, Dr. Watson is the narrator, because mm-hmm. you don't want Sherlock Holmes revealing everything he's thinking. You know,
right.
And so if the character, and, you know, of course, you're not going to reveal everything that, you know, even in first person, you're not going to reveal everything that the character is thinking as they're going through their day. Oh, I have to go to the bathroom. Oh, I'm feeling a bit peckish, whatever, you know, like, unless it's relevant to the story. Mm-hmm. But the way to me that it feels like a cheat is that the character, the main character here, Jimmy, in the hospital, is not, like, the fact that he wouldn't be thinking about the fact that his wife did this and he only figured it out later is, mm-hmm. it's, you know, it's kind of, it to me, it does feel like a cheat. It does feel mm-hmm. like, oh, that's not. And so I would rather see this from Ben Sanders' point of view, and have him be trying to figure out, like, he's got these two people, and the you know, the wife and the husband, and the facts, just nothing really computes, nothing really makes hmm. sense, because that's not really rational.
And, right. Killing someone's own dog is not a rational
yeah.
thing to do.
No. And I think that it makes it hard to figure out, like, what we don't know what Jimmy's motive is going through, you know, like what motivates him through this? Like, why did he try to kill himself? Why, you know, what is he trying to hide from the detective? And because he's the point of view character and essentially the, you know, the protagonist in this story, it's hard to, you know, like it's hard to really connect with him when we can't really know what his motive is, except to kind of, you know, nobody wants to get in trouble.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Besides protecting himself.
Right.
But we don't even understand his motive for jumping in front of the car. Like David is right, you know, to hide the, or David is right to place the discovery that the wife is the one doing all this at the end. Like,
yeah.
like having it revealed earlier would just dilute the story entirely.
Yeah. Yeah.
But this would, again, like the detective is the one, like he should be telling the story. And even, you know, the log line, that's what the log line says it's doing, but that's not what's happening in the story. And it would be so much better if it did. Like the log line knows what the story should be. And this is great practice in here. Like this, when I was reading through this, I was like, I've seen plenty of this type of stuff, like in additional material, you know, that an author will write things from a different point of view so that they can understand the character more.
Mm-hmm.
And then use some of that to help fill in the rest of the story. And that's what I would say, you know, this is a great exercise in really finding out who Jimmy is and how he thinks about things. But we need to then tell the story from the detective's point of view and have a real investigation taking place.
Mm-hmm.
And putting the stakes, like we need to know what the stakes are. Like is Jimmy just being interviewed because he's a potential suicide and they need to put him into a behavioral health center? Or is he being interviewed because of the murder? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and
in which case I think a lot of things would be handled differently.
Mm-hmm.
Like, visiting hours at the hospital are of no moment if a detective is investigating a murder.
Right.
And when you have, so, and let, I mean, it's one thing if the patient is like moving in and out of consciousness is to, you mm-hmm. know, where the
ICU.
Yeah. where the interview would actually threaten the person's life, essentially, you know, that their health is not stable enough. But in this, he's in a lot of pain, but clearly he's stable. And mm-hmm. so it strains my, you know, my willing suspension of disbelief he doesn't introduce himself. He doesn't say, I'm Ben and I want to ask you some questions and, mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. And, you know, and I think that there's some legal murkiness as well, if any of this information is going to come in at court, and that kind of thing, which is all beside the point.
Right.
Just, you know, just little facts and things. But I think overall in the execution that it would be really strong. And even we, you know, as we talked about earlier, this could be expanded into a novella or a novel pretty mm-hmm. easily that would be very powerful shifting that point of view to Ben's. And first person might be a good choice if Ben were the person. Or, mm-hmm. you know, or third person might be, you know, third person limited might be as well. So I don't want to say like, oh, this is the right thing to do in this story. But what I'm seeing is that the first person from Jimmy's point of view is not, it doesn't work as well as something else would, I think. And it's not so the story can't be as powerful.
Right. And, you know, I had something in it. All this went away. So the detective, you know, like having him be the first person point of view character if he was at the scene of the original accident, if he was one of the people that came over when the dog or when the kind of threats and things are happening. Mm-hmm. And so that he's been a part of it as well. Mm-hmm. And another thing that that I was just thinking about, because reading the parts of the nurses out loud, that it seems a little like it makes me wonder, is Jimmy really honestly telling the truth about all the people in town hating him? Mm-hmm. Or has there been so much time that has taken past between the time that Linda Bell's child has died and everyone was hating him and now they don't, because the nurses seem very polite and nice to him, like mm-hmm. not in just a clinical way, but like seem to actually be okay with him.
Yeah. Yeah. So. And they're sending the detective away. They're not like, oh yeah, you can stay for a little while longer. Right. Yeah. So I think these are all things that could be, you know, could be tweaked. And that the biggest challenge is changing the point of view, mm-hmm. and then determining in what order you reveal certain things when the detective asks a question, when Jimmy chooses to answer, like what he chooses to answer and reveal, and at what point he kind of comes clean. Mm-hmm. And I actually think it would be really interesting if Ben Sanders were the one, if the detective were the one who revealed, oh, by the way, your wife, you know, like he pieces it together for Jimmy. And mm-hmm. and that anyway, so those are just possibilities, and I don't want to, like, it's the author's story, and I wouldn't want to say, oh, you must do it this way. But what I would say is that there are a lot of really interesting options that would make mm-hmm. the story just spectacular.
Yeah, because the elements that are in this story are perfect for psychological thriller. Yeah. Like, these are great events. These are great, you know, the characters that are setting up against each other and the events that took place and then the events that follow and the wife. Like, these are all fantastic elements. We just need to assemble them just a little bit different to get the maximum effect. Mm-hmm. And I don't want David to, like, listen to this and think that we're being all negative about the story, because that's not it. Like, this is a moment. Like, I think every author needs to understand this, that we all are working and we have to practice, mm-hmm. right? Like, it's the oddest thing. Like, writing seems to be the only art where the artist doesn't feel the need to practice. Mm-hmm. You know, like the painter goes in and paints different types of things in just color, mm-hmm. and just, you know, to practice elements of the stroke and different things like that. The sculptor does the same. You know, all this, we practice all the time. Or the musician is in there doing hours of work on the notes, but. Mm-hmm. The author seems to always want to just put out the work and just be done with it. And so, like, we forget that we need to sit down and practice. So we need to write additional things in our story that we know will never make it into the final work. Because mm-hmm. that just improves our craft and it makes us a more powerful storyteller.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree that we need to practice. We need to play around with things and experiment, mm-hmm. because that's how we get better. And not everything is going to be usable, but it's all grist for the mill.
Yeah. 5,800 words, I think, is what was cut from Another Day, Another Name. And it went from this clunky, overexposed story to really tight, actionable and thriller. Uh-huh. And like, I was, you know, it hurt at first, because there were some of those scenes that I was just so connected with, but mm-hmm. working with my editor, and she helped me see the light, and I was like, okay, you know what, I'm going to do this because I want to become better at what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, I wanted to, I mean, just one other thing that I wanted to mention about the story as it's written now is that our framing story through which we're kind of, so we have him in the, we have Jimmy in the hospital, and he's, you know, he's telling his story to the detective, and also thinking about it. And mm-hmm. and that the when we're moving in and out of the framing story or between the framing story and then the events of the accident and all of that, that we're that it's not as smooth in all places as I would like to see. And most of that happens in the rest of the story beyond what we have in what we've read. So oh. I wanted to mention that. And the author agreed to have the, you know, to allow us to put the story up on the full story in our show notes. So mm-hmm. that'll be, so you can go and read that and kind of get a feel for how those changes and how the twist is revealed and uh-huh. all of that, which would be
go ahead. Helpful. Sorry.
I was just going to say, I think that would be useful.
Yeah. And a story like this, and this is for everyone who's listening. If you have a short story, you know, 10,000 words, 1,000 or whatever it is, practice this, you know, tell the story from Grant's point of view, tell the story from the detective point of view, tell the story from the wife's point of view, tell the story from Linda Bell's point of view. Like, how does that story change when you're telling it from those different people? Mm-hmm. And like, it's, again, it's a practice and just see what happens, you know, and see what each of the characters are really like and how the depth of that story changes and who does Linda Bell actually telling her story to, you know, and who, you know, how does the wife see herself? Like mm-hmm. maybe has some dissociative disorder, you know, where she doesn't actually even see herself as doing what she's doing, you know, and it's almost like another character there. Like, so experiment, try it out, practice.
Mm-hmm. And that, you know, it's funny is I didn't include that as part of the editorial mission for this week.
Oh.
But I would add that. So when you're deciding, you know, that you, yeah, that to practice, to play around with, to write a scene or two in another character's point of view or switching from first person to third person and mm-hmm. just and see where, you know, where does the story really come alive
yeah.
for you and like where you're most interested? And that will be a great indicator. Mm-hmm. So I guess I should get to the editorial
yeah.
mission.
Yeah. Do you have a full editorial mission?
I do. I have actually a whole, you know.
And they could probably get that somewhere too, like later if they were driving in their car.
Yeah. If you're driving in your car, you can you can go by writership.com/episodes. And you can also sign up to have them delivered right to your inbox. But for the mission this week, here are some questions to help you choose your point of view. So when you're initially choosing, and then when you're reviewing your choice after you've written your draft, then consider these questions. How many perspectives do you need? So the shorter the work, the more likely you'll just want to stick with one person, but you may need more than one. Do you need an objective or subjective narrator? So somebody who has a strong bias, or do you need a straight up, these are just the facts? Do you need to contrast the character's actions? So as Nick Mamadas noted, if a character's thoughts match his or her actions exactly, the thoughts aren't interesting and are probably not necessary. So you wouldn't need a point of view that allows you to reveal those. Then what are the advantages and disadvantages of each choice? And that's when experimenting, I mean, there's a list of standard advantages and disadvantages, but I want you to look at it from the point of view of uh-huh. your story, of your specific story. And what are the advantages? The advantage is, well, this, I can reveal this fact through this person, but a disadvantage is I would have to reveal more than worrying about cheating or that kind of thing. So look at it from the perspective of your specific story. And then consider whose story is this? Who has the most at stake? who changes the most as a result of the events of the story. And these aren't determinative because, you know, in the end, you want, like, who's going to best tell the story? But these are things to consider. Who has the best vantage point? Whose perspective can convey that story so that you're revealing your controlling idea or theme? Like, who can reveal that? Who has the best voice? And do you need distance or do you need intimacy? Because you can adjust the narrative distance, as we talked about, within a point of view, but this is more easily accomplished in an omniscient, in third omniscient, than in first, for example. And then which character has a secret you want to avoid revealing early in the story? So that's the mission for the week.
Perfect. And before I get to the last little bit that I need to do, I just wanted to mention, let's see, it's Rashomon, I believe is the name. It's a Japanese book that has the same story told multiple times from different points of view. And then I believe the movie is called Vantage Point, which is, does the same thing. And so this is something you can look at to see how a story would be told from different points of view if you want to take a look how someone else has done it.
Oh, that's brilliant. Awesome. So, I'll include that in the show notes.
And remember, the Writership Podcast is brought to you by Jim Kukral and Author Marketing Club. Jim has just launched a new business for nonfiction authors called Business Around a Book. So if you're a nonfiction author, visit www.businessaroundabook.com and let Jim help you turn your nonfiction book into a profitable, life-changing business. That's businessaroundabook.com.
Okay, and if you want to engage with us beyond these regular episodes and pitch in your support, you can visit patreon.com/writership. If you enjoy the show, we would love for you to leave a rating and review on iTunes or Stitcher. And if you have technical challenges with that, we have instructions on the website. If you want your five pages reviewed, you can visit writership.com/submissions. Finally, be sure to check out episodes of The Book Editor Show, which Clark hosts with Peter Turley. That's it for episode 102. We'll see you next time on the Writership Podcast.
Ready for Leslie and Clark to help you find the treasure in your manuscript? Submit your pages to writership.org/podcast.